Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Welcome to another edition of the Minnesota Beercast, wrapping up the snowy, cold month of February.
Record-breaking.
Oh, I'm so glad February's ending. Winter ends at the end of February, right?
I don't know.
That's what I've always been told.
Okay.
That's what scientists say.
I'll take your word for it.
So as of tomorrow, we should be all right.
Sure. Sounds good to me, man.
It has been a brutal month of February, but that's why we're here, to not only warm your ears, but warm your taste buds and your bellies with tasty beers and spirits. And there's all sorts. You got food in there?
Yeah, man.
What is going on?
We've got Yeah from Union Kitchen in here. He's going to talk about some of the food that he's brought in and that he features at Sociable Cider Works. We've got Dickie from Ladonia. Did I say that right, Dickie?
Ladonia Cerveceria.
Ladonia Cerveceria. Look at that. I am broadening my horizons every week. And we've got Andy from the Royal Foundry. How you doing, man?
Doing good.
Fantastic. So yeah, we've got a broad spectrum today. We're gonna get into it. Where should we start, Drew?
I don't know, man. You're the one with all the food and drink in there. You tell me.
Well, let's.
I'm in here all by myself. Just mouth watering, looking at all that.
Why don't you come get something to drink?
Somebody's got to run the board in here.
All right, fine. Well, let's start with the food before it gets cold. Yeah, you've been on the show before, but for those who may not have heard, tell us what you do and what you're about, man, because it's delicious. Let's just start there.
Yeah, thanks. So about 3 years ago, we started a pop-up restaurant called Union Kitchen. I've worked around with some of the different restaurants here, and it just felt like it was time for me to kind of start my own thing. I never intended to do this. I never intended to, actually, first and foremost, I tell people, like, I never intended to really cook, because I mean, I cooked growing up in college and stuff like that, cooking in restaurants, and mm-hmm. I hated it. I always tell people that me and the kitchen, it's like that ex-girlfriend you keep breaking up with, but like 6 months later, you get back with her.
Yeah.
And then eventually, you're like, I'm so mad, we're done. You know, and then, but you get back, and then
3 o'clock in the morning, you dial that kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. You gave her that Facebook poke, kind of you. And then 15 years into it, I'm like, oh, you know, like, I guess I kind of love you and stuff, so might as well put a ring on it. And so we started out as pop-up, and what we really wanted to focus on was Hmong food, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't use the word traditional Hmong food, because the word tradition, and I really think in Hmong culture, the word tradition is a very open and closed hand kind of word. So we really want to focus on Hmong food that represented the local region of where we live here in Minnesota. So we started doing our pop-ups. And then about this past summer, Jim and Wade from Sociable approached us, and mm-hmm. we've been good friends with them for the last couple of years. And they're like, hey, we have this idea. We want to buy a food trailer, but we don't want to run the food trailer. So what if we bought the food trailer and you guys do a residency in it? And it was so cool. They brought us in the process. They had us help them design the food trailer. Wade is super funny, because he's like, I know nothing about this, so you can do it. And I faked it a little bit. I'm like, yeah, I got you, bro. I don't know what I was doing.
Third one of these I've done. No
yeah.
problem.
I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then we built it. Well, we didn't build it. They built it down in Miami.
Okay.
Florida, and then they shipped it up here, and then we put it together, and we got in January 2nd, we got in there, and we opened, and I tell a lot of people that we MacGyver a lot of situations, you know, where you're like, well, duct tape and PVC piping, and let's do it.
It's all about improvising.
Yeah, I know. and it's been kind of interesting with the harsh weather. Here, and there are days you come in and everything is frozen, and like your will to like survive kind of has to kick in, you know.
One of the questions that I have for you, being in residence mm-hmm. there and doing the preparation and the serving in that kind of trailer environment setting, I think that one of the struggles with the quote-unquote food truck scene, and I don't know that we want to put you into that box, right? I mean, you're maybe walking around it a little bit, but it seems like for the folks who aren't in residence like you are, mm-hmm. they're kind of living and dying by the night of the week, by the weather, by the event, by the audience that comes into the tap room, right? By you being there every week, you're able to kind of stretch that out across the entire week, right?
Yeah. So I think we come from a little different background because we were doing pop-ups like once a week, once every 2 weeks. So we would get people that would request and be like, hey, when's your next pop-up? Like, when's the next time we can get, you know, get in and eat with you guys? So we kind of built this demand for the last 2 years. It's like, hey, when are you getting your own brick and mortar? Everybody knows in the restaurant world, brick and mortar is expensive. Mm-hmm. It's a big risk. What Sociable has created for us here is kind of like, we're taking a risk, but they're really helping us with that risk. You know, they built a there's a structure that we cook out of. You know, I mean, obviously we still have a commissary kitchen where we do kind of like the larger prep there, mm-hmm. but we finish everything off on the trailer. So, I'm one of those, I think, I'm my father's son. My dad's been one of those guys who's like, I might not know how to do this, but dang it, we're going to just like, you know, figure it out. You know, like, that's how my dad is. You know, we moved to America when we were, when I was like 5 years old. You know, I was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And my dad moved us here and he didn't know an ounce of English, but he's like, here's my family. I got to figure it out. Like, if I want my family to make it, I got to figure it out. Oh, yeah. And he did it, you know, and he worked hard and he put us all through high school, all through college, like, you know, with his family. And still, you know, today, his English is still not that great, but he is a hard worker. And I think something like that instilled inside of me, you know, when I look at the other boys in there, I'm like, hey, it's going to suck. It's going to be cold. We're going to be tired. But like, let's just push it through. So I always tell them, on your worst day, today will be your worst day. You know, like, I mean, there were points where we couldn't feel our hands, you know, and everybody was just standing over the grill with your hand just to warm up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is our worst day. So it gets better from here, you know? And so
that's pretty cool, man. That's a American dream type stuff right there.
Yeah. And knowing that my dad sacrificed a lot, my dad and my mom, they both sacrificed a lot. And, you know, I was just telling somebody, I said, you know, for them, it wasn't that they wanted to live the American dream. They are willing to sacrifice everything so that their children can have a shot at the American dream. And that's just a different mentality of love. Well, like, from them.
Do you have kids yet?
I don't.
So I will tell you, as a dad, that is the American dream. Like, I don't, at this point, I don't do things for myself. Mm-hmm. Like, being able to come and sacrifice and work hard and give your kids the opportunity, that might as well be the American dream. So that's pretty cool. Props to your folks and props to you for working hard and making it last, man. Cause that's pretty admirable. That's really cool.
Appreciate it.
We do have the, you know, a significant Hmong community, but as far as like the outside of that and the broader community as a whole, are people familiar with Hmong food generally? Are they familiar with the flavors? Do they know what to expect? Or do you get the sense that this is something that they don't get the opportunity to try as often as they might like?
Yeah. So there's a few layers to that, to the answer to that question. I think one is, so the first Hmong refugees came into the Twin Cities area in 1975. Right after that, some of them started opening their own food shops. Well, the problem is, you say Hmong food, and, you know, back in the late 80s, like, nobody knew what Hmong food was, you know? Right. It was just, it's like, oh, they're Southeast Asians, you know? So a lot of the first generation Hmong entrepreneurs, especially in the food world, they worked under the banner of Thai, Vietnamese, or Chinese, because it was marketable. So it was, you know, because a lot of Hmong flavors come from that Southeast Asian region. So there's a lot, if you go down like in Dinkytown, in Frogtown and on University Ave, there's a lot of shops there that will say Thai something, or, you know, like, or some kind of like, either like Chinese name or even Vietnamese name. Well, a lot of them are owned by Hmong owners, you know, but they had to do that because they had to make it work.
Branding, right?
Yep. It's all about branding, because if you have like white dudes coming in, they're not going to be like, what's Hmong food in the late 80s, right? So they're going to be like, oh, Thai food, we get it, you know, kind of.
So has that changed or evolved? I know, you know, I was telling the guys earlier when you're putting out this food, I'm like, you guys are going to love this sticky rice. Mm-hmm. But I don't see, and maybe it's maybe not where I hang out. I mean, I'm almost not too far from Frogtown, mm-hmm. but I don't see a ton of Hmong restaurants. I don't know how accessible mm-hmm. it is to a guy like myself. Do you feel that there's, you know, that kind of cross culture mixing? Do you feel like there are middle-aged white dudes looking for your next pop-up?
I think that what we've been able to do is we've been able to transcend just the food, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say that Hmong food isn't a type of food. It's a philosophy of food. It's a way of thinking about food. If you come to my mom's house and she's cooking for you, the moment you walk in to the moment you walk out, that whole experience has been Hmong food. And when you leave our house, trust me, like, they'll pack whatever's left for you to go. Because, like, that's a very Hmong tradition. It's
what are you doing after the show?
But we also want plenty for you to take on the road.
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of that is, that's part of Hmong food. So, like, when at the trailer, when we do the food, I always tell the boys, I'm like, just because this food comes out of trailer doesn't mean that we half-heartedly do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because there's always that mentality, like, oh, trailer food. It's like, you know, it's good. It's like good beer food or good cider food or whatever. But I'm like, no, like, we're not going to do that. Like, when people come eat this with us, it's like they're eating from our mom and our dad's table, you know? For me, cooking this food has nothing to do about, like, you know, pat on the back or accolades or stuff. You know, if that stuff happens, that's great. But it's about my parents' legacy. Like when sticky rice and grilled pork was the things that my mom and dad made for us, you know, and especially my mom. My mom always made sure that there was food on the table. No matter how hard the struggle was, no matter how hard to earn this stuff, they always made sure there's food on the table. And so I get a lot of, like, you know, we want to reflect a lot of that.
Well, you brought food for our table. Let's take a little break, come back, and talk about what you brought. We'll run through the kind of the ingredients, the recipes, just briefly, and then we'll talk about some of the ciders you brought, too. We'll do that after the break. You're listening to the Minnesota Beercast on AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Welcome back to the Minnesota Beercast. Look, if you have not signed up yet to join us for Oktoberfest in Munich, there's still time. There's still spots available.
Yeah.
Head over to MinnesotaBeerCast.com. Head over to the Minnesota Beercast Facebook page. You can find a link there with all the details. Also available on the Justice and Drew show page and TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You can find the itinerary and links of how to sign up there. Do it now.
It's going to be a grand old time.
I can't wait. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, just the Oktoberfest part of it, not to mention like the tour of the castles and all the historic tour. It's gonna be, it's amazing. I can't even wait.
We're going to where like the Sound of Music was set and all that.
Yeah,
I've already got my dress picked out.
Well, you've been wearing it all week.
Gonna cosplay as Julie Andrews.
For once, it's gonna be location appropriate.
For once, finally, I actually get to wear the dress in the appropriate setting. It's gonna be awesome.
Take a
you
selfie.
Don't want to miss that.
Take a selfie. It's gonna be fantastic. Well, we just got done kind of running through the cooking philosophy with Ye Vang from Union Kitchen. We've been chowing down on your sticky rice and your pork. Can you tell us how you make this sticky rice and this pork? Because I want it every day of my life.
Yeah, for sure. So the sticky rice, we just call it purple sticky rice. It's two kinds of rice you use. There's a black rice to make it sound exotic, sometimes called the forbidden black rice.
Ooh.
You can sell it a little bit more if it's forbidden black rice. Anyways, right? It's black rice, and then you get your sweet rice. It's called high gluten sweet rice, or it's a sticky rice. So you soak them together.
Okay.
The black rice is kind of like wild rice, you know. It has a little bite to it, has a little tooth to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the sweet rice or the sticky rice is actually what kind of has that stickiness to it. And so you soak them together overnight, and then the black rice kind of seeps, you know, so it creates like this purple dye.
Yeah.
And then so that's where you get it. Some places they cheat a little bit, I'll be honest. Some places they just take red and blue food color and they just, you know,
do a little razzle dazzle.
Yeah. With the black rice, it's a little pricier.
Yeah.
So that's why I like some places do that. But I really love that texture.
Mm-hmm.
When I first learned how to do this, I had to actually my mom and my aunt actually had to sit us down and like show us how to do it. And we do it pretty old school. We put it in a steamer, you know, and everything. If you find the right ratios, you can put it in a regular rice steamer, but we use like a real, you know, real steamer and everything. So yeah,
that's pretty cool. And how about the pork?
Yeah, the pork is pretty, like I tell people, it's super stupid easy to make. It's get a good fire. Make sure it's, you know, nice embers, and then you just take a pork shoulder and you cut it, you know, kind of thick. You want it thick. And then you just put it on that fire, salt, and you keep grilling it until you want that real good char on the outside. And then we make a sauce. We just call it our sweet and sour sauce. We actually, you know, like, you know how there's the General Tso's, you know, mm-hmm. sauce?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a very famous general in Hmong history called General Vang Pao. So we just call it the General Vang Pao sauce. and it's our version. We kind of started out as a joke for wings.
Yeah.
And then we're just like, hey, dude, why don't we just call this the General Vang Pao sauce and then the General Tso sauce? So it's GVP sauce, nice. We call it. I don't know. Some people might get mad about it, but we're like, I don't know. It's Hmong culture, Hmong history, and something, you know.
Get on it, man.
I think the general will be very happy that we made a sauce after him. But anyways, so it's a sauce we make. The base of it is gochujang, which is a Korean fermented Korean chili paste, honey, garlic, ginger. I think there's a couple other things in there. It's not like I don't want to say. I just can't remember. And yeah, and then it's got this little bit of funk in it, which I really like, but it's got this sweetness and spice that balances out. And then you just paste that on there, and you just keep rotating it, and it creates a crust, this beautiful, like, char crust.
Well, it's going pretty good with the blood orange that you brought for us. It's I think it cuts through some of those pretty intense flavors pretty well. Mm-hmm. Kind of cleans everything off. I enjoy it. It's pretty tasty.
Yeah, it's beer food. Like, you know, Hmong food is really beer food, basically, if you think about it, you know.
Well, speaking of beer and beer food, let's talk some more beer. Let's Dickie, you've been making beer at La Doña Cerveceria. Tell us about it.
So the ones I brought that we're trying right now is Doña Fria, which is originally from the Doña Cella that Sergio had contract brewed out at Sand Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Some minor adjustments to it, bringing it onto our system. But the other two, one's an infusion with Serrano pepper, and then one of the IPAs that we have. And so what we wanted to really get a hold of is having a nice presence of a corn flavor while still maintaining a dryness to the beer, instead of having the sweetness of the beer counteract the sweetness of the corn flavor.
So I don't think we've had you on before. We should back the train up and give folks kind of the history, the backstory of La Doña Cerveceria. How did the whole thing start?
So like anything, it's guys drinking saying we should make beer.
you know it would be a great idea.
We should really make beer. We can make this better.
So how did they go from that to you making the beer?
So they contract brewed, like I said, out of Sand Creek, mm-hmm. got bottles, started selling them at liquor stores, realized they weren't making any money off of it because they just wanted to get a presence. Well, that presence finally reflected to quite a few people with some deeper pockets that said, hey, this might be a good thing. A lot of people are doing it. Seemed like it worked out pretty well. And so they got funding, they got a loan, they started ordering equipment, and then said, we don't know how to brew beer. We need somebody to brew beer. And fortunately enough, one of Sergio's friends.
I want to know who supplied the funding without asking that question first.
Yeah, right.
Can you give me their number? Ask,
that was one of their questions. You know, I don't know. You'd have to ask them, but somehow it all worked out. One of Sergio's friends, I did a beer with Save the Boundary Waters,
mm-hmm.
Canoe Country, when I was at Northgate. And he said, oh, yeah, why don't you call him up? And neither one of them had my phone number. So Sergio slides into my DMs on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I think it's just this kind of joke thing, like, oh, yeah, you're starting a brewery. That's cool.
Right.
And lo and behold, we meet a dangerous man. And he's like one of those old-fashioned, you know, movies where he slides a piece of paper across the table. I'm like, oh, you're serious? Oh, okay.
Did it have a number on it, and did you write another zero on there for him?
It was folded. I basically took that home and showed my wife, and she told me I'd be an idiot if I didn't jump on this opportunity. Otherwise, I'd just be making the same beers for somebody else my entire life.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, the the identity. Talk about the identity of the brewery a little bit. You know, I think craft beer specifically has had a problem with kind of being, I don't know, I don't think whitewash is a good term, but it's been very monochromatic. And we've got, I think, here today a good representation of what there are possibilities beyond that. You know, Yi has talked about his culture a little bit, and I think there's even more to talk about with the identity of La Doña. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, the identity really reflects on Mexican and Latin culture. As soon as you walk in, there's a statue of, you know, Doña Fría, you know, the woman of death or the madam of death. And, you know, when you walk in, all the colors, the bright lights, you know, it's kind of industrial, the way that the walls aren't really painted, floor is all beat up, just like kind of a warehousey feel and vibe. But then with these slight accents that just kind of invite you into it. And coinciding with that, I wanted to make beer that would also invite people not only to just chase down the most bitter beer possible, but to allow them to taste an actual spectrum of each style that is quite prevalent in the beer community. You know, you have a brown ale, and then we have a brown ale with coffee. We have a pale ale. We have a blonde ale. We have the lager. We have two IPAs that, you know, between 65 and 75 IBUs, but don't taste like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a really inviting beer culture that I wanted to promote, along with, you know, being able to promote people to come in to Saturday night salsa nights, you know.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Just kind of have fun.
I love salsa.
It's
my favorite chip topping.
You seem like the kind of guy that would, you know, bust out a pretty mean salsa.
Queso and salsa.
No, I'm talking about the dance.
Oh, I thought, I don't dance.
We're going to salsa later.
Okay. All right. Well, we are up against another break. We're going to come back, stop making terrible jokes, and talk some more about beer with Dickie from La Doña Cerveceria. And then we're going to get into the Royal Foundry Spirits after this. You're listening to the Minnesota Beercast on AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Welcome back to the Minnesota Beercast, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, available anytime, anywhere on the iHeart Radio app. You can access all of our past episodes there. It's the best way to keep up with the show. You go there, you hit the little follow button, you'll get notified when new episodes are posted weekly.
So, I've been eating this.
Yeah, how is it? I wouldn't know.
Well, you have to be in the booth and do your thing over there. So
I miss all the fun.
The sacrifice you have to make. And
I'm a man of many sacrifices.
It was fantastic with Dickie's beer. You weren't lying. Yeah, this is phenomenal beer drinking food. Speaking of your beer, Dickie, from La Doña Cerveceria, tell me about some of these other beers that you brought in here. I'm especially curious about the, you said you have one with Serrano, is that correct?
Yeah, I do. I have a couple infusion kegs that I play around with, and
can you pass one of them is, over here while we talk about
it? Yeah. And one of them is the Doña Fría, the Mexican lager that I make, and then I add a half ounce of Serrano peppers to the infusion keg while I'm kegging it off.
So what makes it a Mexican lager as opposed to a German lager?
I guess there's no real difference when you actually break it down, because it traveled with, you know, the people coming from Europe to Mexico and South America and all that. So it's really like an offshoot of like a Bavarian lager, like Vienna or whatever. It's dark in color.
Mm-hmm.
It has a nice sweetness to it, in this case being corn, and then it just washes away clean. This one, however, with the Serrano pepper, kind of sticks with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes really well hand in hand.
Serrano is one of my favorite peppers. That's why I was excited to hear that you brought it. I love Serrano. It's in chili especially. Drew and I do a chili contest every year. This year I won. Mm-hmm. It did have some Serrano peppers in it. Unfortunately, Drew's probably going to lose next year too. But I do love some Serrano peppers. What's so funny?
Why are you jumping ahead to next year already?
Just saying. I mean, I think first year was a fluke.
Who won the People's Choice this year? You remember?
I don't recall a People's Choice.
I just as far as I'm concerned, I'm 2-0.
Okay. Yeah. Keep thinking that.
Now, Serrano's are fantastic peppers, and this is a fantastic beer. My goodness, it is tasty.
Thank you.
So is this something that kind of shows up when peppers are available, or how do you decide what comes on the tap lines?
Just by seasons. Usually while I'm working, I'll think like, oh, maybe I want to make this one. Which is great because I have the system to do it. It's 15 barrels, so when we usually get done, it's about 90% yield, so you end up with about, you know, anywhere between 27 and 29 kegs out of a batch. And when you have salsa night on Saturdays, as well as typically Thursdays and Fridays being some of the busier days, and funny enough, Mondays.
Oh, really?
It just flies through.
I think Monday would be the... I mean, Monday is kind of traditionally a slower day, isn't it? How do you guys have so busy on Monday?
Well, luckily for both of us, they built that nice overpass going over the impound lot to 394. So people getting off work on Monday are like, you know what? I'm just going to go over there, have a couple, get back on the highway.
Wait it out.
Go home. Not enough to, you know, inebriate me too much, but, you know, I've been meaning to go over there, check it out, see what else is around there. Today's the day.
You know what? If there's a day where you're going to wait out traffic and have yourself a beverage or three, it's probably a Monday, right?
Right.
So, I can endorse that move. So you're not too far from Royal Foundry, right? You guys are fairly close together, is that right?
We're right next door. We're actually connected to each other. Same building. So.
Same building.
Yeah.
So yeah. Oh, you guys are... already fast friends.
Yep.
Is there any collaboration plans in the works?
We haven't gotten to that yet, but I've been so headlong in production and then also a lot of the build-out components in terms of from the design to physically building our bar to our tables, etc. So I've been...
As well as your leg.
Yeah, I ruptured my Achilles towards the end of trying to get... our place open, so...
How are you going to play soccer with the ruptured Achilles?
Well, thankfully, it's the winter time right now, so hopefully by springtime, and also the soccer that you guys have next door at Ladonia is futsal, so I can... There's not as much running in that version of soccer, so... I've got some good passers, I'll be able to.
So if anybody knows me, they know I'm a giant soccer fan. But why don't you tell us a little about the soccer league that you guys have going on at Ladonia Dickey?
So there are four seasons, or I guess leagues you can sign up for. There's the spring, early summer, late summer, and fall that you'll be able to sign up for. And there are three different classes for each one, I believe. First one being casual, intermediate, and then super hardcore.
and then there's a secret fourth level for intense guys like myself. You have to know the handshake, and if you go in and give them the handshake, you can sign up for the secret fourth level.
Oh.
But you don't tell anyone because it's like
yeah, as I say, first rule,
yeah,
secret soccer club. You don't talk about secret soccer club.
It's played in the dark of the night.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. I dig it. The interplay of sports and activity along with the beer culture for, you know, lack of a better term. I don't know if that's too, I don't know, cliche a word to use, beer culture. But, I mean, I think that's a real thing. I think that there's a culture around the nature of beer and craft beer here in Minnesota. But I think that it's neat to, because, you know, much like the food, the camaraderie, the music, I think it goes well with activities and sports as well. I mean, there's nothing better than going out and doing some football, and then afterwards, man, time for a cold beverage.
Absolutely, yeah.
It makes perfect sense to me. So is it 3-on-3 league? Is that correct? How do you guys break it down?
Yeah, so it's 3-on-3, and then depending on which class you sign up for, You basically sign up for specific days as well of the week. So that way you have a consistent schedule. You can have up to 6 people on your team. Okay. All have to be over 21.
Of course.
I have to say that.
Right. Legally, he's obligated to say that. That's cool. And then you guys can rotate in, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, hockey where you got your bruiser line and you've got your fast line, right?
Yeah, exactly. You
got your enforcer.
Exactly.
Yeah. His sole job is just to kick the crap out of people.
Which, by the way, I have to say, please don't.
He's also legally obligated to say that.
Yeah. Legally obligated.
My lawyers would like me to add, please don't do that.
That's awesome, man. I love it. The more, you know, we talk about sometimes how the market is getting more crowded and more competitive, and you know, that's the way the ball bounces, but stuff like this is what makes it fun. And yeah, the craft beer world is getting more competitive, but we're seeing stuff like Ladonia where it's not your average cookie cutter craft brewery, and you've got things like, you know, this fantastic lager with some Serrano in it, and it's not overpowering, but it's there. And it's lovely, and you guys are having soccer and salsa night, and God bless you, man. I think it's great. It's fantastic.
Thanks a lot.
It's, yeah, lovely. Let's take a break. Let's come back and talk some spirits with Royal Foundry after this. You're listening to Minnesota Beercast on AIM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Segment of this week's Minnesota Beer Cast. It's always sad. Makes me sad.
No, let's have a cocktail and celebrate. It's been a great show thus far. It's only going to get better.
Has been wonderful.
It has. I'll drink to that.
Cheers.
we've been saving the last segment for spirits. Welcome to the show, Andy. Thanks for being patient, man.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Is there a burp button with all this beer drinking going on?
the cough button also doubles as a belching button.
People have been known to use it for that.
I'll have to put that into effect.
we kind of got the origin story of yeah and of Ladonia. Let's get the origin story of Royal Foundry.
Well, actually, we have a kind of a similar story, well, along the lines of Sergio and his ownership, and then my part of ownership and part of the founders group of our distillery. He's a first generation from Uruguay, and I'm a first generation from England. Both my parents are from the Windsor area, or if you've ever seen the original Office in the British version, Slough, to be specific. So. My mom, actually, if you've seen that the footage of the intro, her office was that physical building. But, taking my kind of upbringing and my British experiences and my dad teaching me about beer and spirits, where most American dads teach their kids about sports, I was taught about, you know, drinking good beer and drinking good spirits. So.
My dad taught me about sports while I snuck beer out of his cooler. Yeah.
Yeah. But, ultimately that's kind of through those experiences led me to, you know, learn more and more about both, you know, brewing and also making spirits, and kind of deciding that, or looking at the local market and seeing what was being produced in terms of the spirits industry, that there was definitely a nice window to really kind of showcase craft British style spirits, from a gin to a single malt whiskey, and then also playing with the rum component, because with rums, there's a history with the British Navy, and they used to have a rum ration up until the mid-70s.
'70s?
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
They would get their daily rum, and also a lot of the kind of growth of that rum industry in the Caribbean was kind of spurred on by, you know, the British admirals, Myers rum, Mount Gay rum, etc. They're all kind of built from that. So
that's kind of cool. I want, how large was their daily rum ration? Do you know into this?
It was I think it was basically a cup of.
You can just make something up.
I'm gonna make it up, but
yeah,
I'm not sure if it was 2 ounces, what it might be, but yeah. And they would get their rum. The idea was that was to help.
Fight scurvy.
Potentially fight scurvy.
Yeah, or, I buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the whole
I feel scurvy coming on right now.
Well,
Well,
the whole component of the U.S. And people coming to the U.S. originally, or coming to America, the Americas, was actually for clean water.
Really?
No, it wasn't just religious reasons and trying to get away from the Church of England. It was also the idea.
So the Puritans was really about water.
Water, yeah.
Pure water.
Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah, well, because all of Europe's water sources had, by that time, had become like basically the a combo platter of sewer and water source. So sounds
like a good time.
So the whole idea of drinking spirit, you knew that you were safe; you weren't going to die.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, and also that's
why
beer too.
That's why I drink spirits.
Yeah. Well, you brought some spirits here today.
Yes, I did,
and you've made us some fantastic cocktails. What is this? I don't know. It's not quite pink, but it's got a chartreuse, maybe? What is this? Is that the right color? What is this cocktail?
Sure, I'll go with that. It's the Black Knight, and we have a great beverage director and mixologist, Marlon Hansen. He's the one that's put those components together. I'm the one that's producing the spirits, but the Black Knight is a shrub-based cocktail. It's got a whiskey for the spirit, and the whiskey, we've done a blended American whiskey until we get our own whiskey properly aged, and even on that side of things, with producing a single malt, I might not necessarily push it towards that type of cocktail. So I think we'll definitely always have a mixed American style whiskey. So yeah, the shrub component is blackberry vinegar and sugar, and then it's topped off with a club soda. So
when you're saying it's a blended American whiskey, does that mean you're bringing other whiskey in and blending it with what you're
producing? Yes. Well, so you look to Johnny Walker, speaking of single malts or scotch produce scotches, or Scotland scotches. So Johnny Walker doesn't produce a lick of their spirit. You know, they're sourcing single malts from all different single malt producers to create their dynamic blend.
Right.
Obviously, we're not a blender, but kind of inverting or doing a reverse of that. We're taking American style corn based whiskeys to create a American style. It's basically a bourbon because it's pretty much 100% corn mash bill. But we've taken a couple blending a couple different barrels to get that
getting flavor. The flavor profile.
Yeah, and I wanted to have a 4 year plus age whiskey. When it comes to whiskey, my opinion is that that time in barrel, it's hard to cheat that. It's hard to create something that is gonna.
I think that we found that as the spirits scene here in Minnesota matures, that I think people are definitely agreeing with you that some people, I think, have tried to rush the things to market. And I think that there's no substitute for that age.
Yeah, it's in or if learning how to, because there are some pretty dynamic whiskeys that are produced in smaller barrels and they're doing a 2 year, but there's more to that barrel program. There's more to that mash bill that is really pushing that flavor profile. So if you're going in those directions, you can create something that has a bit of mellowness, but ultimately for us, that's, we want to, look to the future and putting down barrels, and then maybe at 3 years or maybe a little bit longer, then we'll put out our single malt.
But, so you guys are going to have this cocktail and I imagine others at your grand opening, the 7th through the 10th of March, correct?
Yep.
What's this other one that you've poured for us? It kind of looks like a ecto cooler, but
yeah, it's in the bar scenario, it would have some garnishes to enhance its.
It's radio. They don't know there's no garnish.
Yeah. Okay. There would be some sort of cucumber, I believe. The cocktail is what's the dill, which is a sour, with a it's a gin based cocktail. So the modifier is a sour.
I like it. This is fantastic.
Setup on that. So
I see this as like a I don't know, like a porch, like hot day, like, you know, something to I don't know, kind of freshen you up and cool down the palate.
Yeah, it's the name itself, it seems like there'd be more, you know, some people might think more pickle tone to it, but it's that right. I think it's got the right balance of just enough, you know, dill component to it, and then the sour component, and then obviously the gin coming through there. It's and that one has our own signature gin in there. The one that I've been working on, trying to get that right botanical ratio and that right flavor profile put together. So
really good.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Thank you.
Yeah, go check out the grand opening of the tap room 7th through the 10th over at Royal Foundry. You're going to have a ton of stuff going. You got the gin, the whiskey, and you guys are going to have a vodka too as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have a vodka. We did a contract vodka because ultimately our spirit approach is and what we're going to have on the shelves and pushing to distribution is our British focus. So ultimately, in order to make our gin, we have to make a vodka.
Makes sense.
But I'm to make the gin that I need to have initially, I need to focus that towards our gin. But for our vodka, you know, we're always going to have a vodka in-house for making cocktails. But for most part, our focus is on our gin production. Next up will be our rum that we'll be pushing out, and then our single malt will have that down the road, but we'll also have some other seasonal gins and some other gin-based liqueurs, etc., and other British inspired spirits.
There you have it. Thank you so much. We are out of time. We will see you next week.
Go sign up to join us on that trip to Germany. Go to MinnesotaBeerCast.com or Minnesota Beercast Facebook page for all the details. We'll see you next week.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Cheers.
Cheers.